morning, everybody. This is Jim Bianco. Welcome to our monthly conference call. A little bit of housekeeping, as is usually the case. There is a handout, and normally people don't have a problem with accessing the handout, but if for some reason you did, you can send an email to Ryan Malo in our office at rmalo@biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn right around and send it to you as an attachment in an email a minute or two later, hopefully. Today's presentation, Petroleum in the Credit Markets. As is usually our case, we try to find topics that we've been discussing to try and fill them in a little bit that happen to be topical. And the credit markets and what's been happening with gasoline prices have been right at the top of the list. The structure for today's conference call is I will speak for about 10 or 15 minutes about the credit markets, and I have Howard Simons on the line with us, too, from our office. He will talk a little bit about petroleum and the gasoline markets afterwards. So let me get started with us on page 2 and at least run through what's been happening in the credit markets as of late. Banking losses and capital raised is what's on page 2. This is a table that we use constantly because I still maintain it's one of the more important measures of trying to assess what's been happening in the financial system. As of June 10th, the last update we have, if you look at the table on the left or if you look at the chart below it, both of them show the same information, whichever is your fancy. We have $392 billion that has been written off by the financial system since the third quarter of last year, and they've raised $291 billion. So they're net down still around $100 billion. As we've been saying, the typical financial firm, typical, it's levered about 14 to 1, some more, some less, but average about 14 to 1. That means it's roughly speaking about 1.4 to 1.5 trillion less available in lending than there was a year ago. The financial system is shrinking. Not only is it shrinking in terms of capital, it's also shrinking in terms of deleveraging. The deleveraging numbers are very difficult to get a handle on. For instance, this week, Lehman Brothers did proudly announce that they've delevered from 32 times to 25 times. Yet Merrill Lynch also reported this week that they are not going to tell anybody their leverage ratio. That's their business, not ours. And that's the problem with getting a handle on the deleveraging. There is gross leverage numbers that we can look at, but there's problems with the gross leverage numbers that make them highly suspect to drawing any big meaning from them. But beyond that, it's up to, on a firm-by-firm basis, let them tell us what they're doing, and they're largely not telling us what they're doing. So the financial system continues to shrink. One of the big problems, and this gets to the news today, is that only $291 billion has been raised against $392 billion in losses. One of the things we found is that as financial firms lose money, their shareholders get mad at them, but they view losses as a temporary thing because you can always talk about that's it, it's a loss, we're going to move forward, there won't be any more losses, maybe there'll even be write-ups when things get better. You raise money and you lose your job. And that seems to be the case over and over again, all the way to today's news with Joe Gregory and Aaron Callan losing their jobs at Lehman Brothers. Not surprisingly, days after a 30% dilution in the stock price. That's one of the problems I think that is we face here as far as raising capital, is that it is a career-ending decision in many cases to raise capital, and that's why a lot of firms have been very difficult to do it. It's not a career-ending decision to report losses. Page 3, the home price market continues to slump. It's still, as this chart shows, Case-Shiller on an annualized basis, and we spliced in the latest monthly data, and it shows that right now, by this measure, this is the worst home price market since 1932. This is a market that, unlike any other market that we've seen. And there's been an argument that's been out there, and I think it's largely correct, that the losses, the $392 billion worth of losses, have largely been in the subprime area, A lot of that stuff has largely been written down. There's nothing left there to lose. So that those losses should then try and moderate themselves, and we shouldn't see those losses continue. And that I would agree with. But if you go to page 4 and you look at this is data that comes directly from Citibank, their first quarter investor presentation. Second mortgages, which cover also cover home equity loans, you could see that the losses there, at least the NCLs and non-conformings in the 90 days past due, have been skyrocketing. From 2 years ago at 14 or 15 basis points, we're up to 145 basis points to 316 basis points. What this is suggesting is that as long as we are in the worst home price market since 1932, yes, the losses will continue. No, they won't continue in subprime, but they can continue in things like Alt A. They can continue in things like home equity loans. They can continue in other areas as well, too, in the housing market. So we may not be past the losses. Another good example of that happens to be, again, the story of the week. Lehman Brothers raised money in April. Their offering was oversubscribed in April. They had the opportunity to raise a lot more money in April, but they elected not to. When they were asked in their conference call earlier this week, why didn't you take the opportunity in April? And the answer was, we didn't think we were going to have the losses, and it's only the middle of June. So they had no visibility beyond the next 60 days as far as the losses that they saw. So it's still more likely that those losses will continue, and the stigma with raising capital will continue as far as we go from there. Now, page 5. What I'm trying to argue here in the first couple pages is the credit crisis is still with us. It never went away. It's changing its form, but the financial system is still under stress. Starting in August, the Federal Reserve started to respond to the credit crisis. The way the Federal Reserve responded to the credit crisis, let's go back and remember what happened in August. They held a meeting on August 7th. The funds rate was at 5.25. They decided they didn't need to do anything. They held the funds rate steady at 5.25. Jim Cramer yelled at them. Everybody said you have to do something about the credit crisis. 10 days later, we had an intra-meeting ease. The market demanded the Fed act, and the Fed listened to the market, and it followed its demands. And that was largely what we saw throughout the fall. They eased 50 basis points in September. The FOMC statement led us to believe that was it. We gave you 225s in September, and we were going to hold. The market demanded that they do more, and they did more. The market demanded that they do more. In December, they invented the TAF auction. The market demanded that they address the Monday of Martin Luther King holiday when we thought the market was going to crash. They cut 75 basis points. Then they cut 58 days later. The market demanded the Fed. The Fed listened to the market, and they moved forward. Throughout that entire period, there was, I want to use the phrase, no consequence to what the Fed was doing. In other words, the Fed eased, the Fed invented a TAF auction or a lending facility, and the market said, this is good, you're dealing with the credit crisis, and that was the extent of it. But as we moved forward, starting in the last month or two, there's been a bit of a sea change. First of all, the chart's on page 5. Let me take the chart on the left, the Taylor rule. John Taylor developed a rule for trying to determine what is the proper level for monetary policy. The actual funds rate is in blue. The Taylor rule's suggested policy level is in red. It shows that right now the actual funds rate is 350 basis points below what the Taylor rule would suggest. The divergence is shown as the bars on green below. That is one of the largest divergences we've seen in the 20-plus years of data shown here. The chart in the upper right shows the targeted funds rate in red. It shows the consumer price index in blue, or the CPI index in blue, and the green arrows point to every time we've had a negative real funds rate, every time the funds rate has been below the inflation rate. 1980, 1993, 2003, and now. In the prior three periods, 1980, 1993, and 2003, it's always ended badly. It's always ended with some kind of a crisis. Of course, in 1980, we had runaway inflation, and Volcker had to eventually raise the funds rate to near 21%, which you can see on the chart. 1993 was followed by 1994, which was the worst bond market in history. 2003 led to the housing bubble and then the bust that we have now. And again, we have negative real funds rate. The chart below that shows the in blue, and the blue bar shows CPI, the same thing as the blue line above. And the red shows the 10-year note. This is only the second time since 1979 that the 10-year note has been trading under the inflation rate. The point of all these charts is the monetary policy is easy. Monetary policy is too easy by most measures. I would argue to you that it really became too easy with that 75 basis point cut on January 22nd and the 50 on January 30th. And from that moment forward, Fed policy became too easy. But from August to about, say, 6 weeks ago, somewhere in there, 8 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, the market was looking past easy Fed policy. Now, all of a sudden, monetary policy has a consequence. And go to page six. In the last several days, what we've seen in the marketplace is we've gone from last Friday, virtually no chance that the Fed was going to tighten rates in the this summer, to putting in odds of around 70%, even higher, warning that the Fed is going to hike in August and possibly hike again in September. Now, this would be out of their mode because normally they don't move in August or September, initiate a new sequence in Fed policy in an election year. They won't want to wait until December. What I'm arguing here is that the market has now decided, or the market has now has a perception that this easy Fed policy is creating inflation, and that the Fed can no longer say we will do what it takes to fight the credit crisis, because do what it takes to fight the credit crisis implies that there's going to be inflation in the system, and the market is asking the Fed, telling the Fed, demanding from the Fed, you deal with the inflation issue as well. That's a nice way to say there's limits to what we're going to allow you to do in dealing with the credit crisis. Or as I wrote here, this is from our News Clips product yesterday, in bold on the left here on page six, the market may be telling the FOMC it's done all it can in dealing with the credit crisis. From here on out, all attempts to soften the blow for financial firms will not work and only serve to heighten inflation expectations. So sick financial firms are on their own and should be allowed to fail. If they've had their chance and if they don't have their house in order by now, it's not going to happen, so let them go. Otherwise, the Federal Reserve will be pumping liquidity into the financial system and keeping the funds rate below the inflation rate for years. The market now views this as unacceptable because the inflation it will create will be worse than the chaos in the financial markets it could possibly prevent. So there's this sea change now. Go ahead, invent all your TAF auctions, expand them. Give loans to the dealers, change the rules at the discount window, cut rates. Fine, you're dealing with the credit crisis. But now, hold on a minute, you're also creating inflation, or the market believes you're creating inflation. I'm not going to let you do anything or whatever it takes to deal with the credit crisis, because all you're doing is creating inflation for the rest of us. So this is going to start to play into the credit crisis too, because the market is going to impose somewhat of a limit on the Fed because it wants the Fed to deal with inflation. Now remember, in August, the Fed said there wasn't a problem. The market demanded that they address the Fed credit crisis, and then 10 days later, we got the intermeeting ease. They cut 50, said that was it. The market demanded more, and they kept giving us more and more. The market is now demanding the Fed change course. And I think that this is important because a lot of people have said the reason the markets have been behaving so poorly in the last 2 weeks is the series of speeches that Greenspan gave, that they were a curveball, they were out of left field. I think that really he's interpreting what the market wants from him, and he's trying to give them tough talk. The problem is the market wants more than tough talk. I think the market's going to demand action, and if he doesn't give the market action, then they're going to be severely disappointed. Page seven, the rational response to the Federal Reserve running easy policy and creating an environment of inflation is for investors to look for investments that would benefit from higher inflation. Now, they don't always look for the same thing every time. Every time a negative real funds rate, we get a different response from investors. This cycle, the negative real funds rate is being viewed as an inflationary outcome. Last cycle in 2003, it was being viewed as something to run you into real estate. Now it's being said, how do I benefit from higher inflation? And the popular investment choice now is the long-only commodity fund. So as the Fed runs inflationary policy, the endowments and the trusts that see that policy say, we should continue to commit money towards investments that would benefit from higher commodity prices. The Fed does influence the price of crude oil. These markets are small. The commodity markets are small. There's a capacity problem. It doesn't take much money to go into those markets and push them higher. So as long as the Fed runs inflationary policy, they inspire, and I pick that word carefully, people to put their money into investments that would benefit from higher inflation, higher commodity prices, into these small markets, and they help to ramp up their prices. I know Bernanke has been out there saying, I can't control the price of crude oil. That's true. He can't create supply. He can't create demand, but he can inspire the speculative activities of the long-only funds, and he's been inspiring a lot of them lately. If you look at these charts on page 7, the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, does give us data on the size of the long-only funds for 12 commodities. They're listed in the top chart. Crude oil, gold is not on the list. I've asked the CFTC. They have no plans to add them to the list anytime soon. The total market capitalization of those 12 commodities is around $150 billion. You can own every futures contract outstanding for those 12 commodities for about $150 billion. The long-only index funds, if you look at the bottom chart, account for 40% of the open long side open interest. The speculators account for something like 18%. As a matter of fact, if you were to look at this data, and we've talked about this in some prior pieces, our guess is that if you were to back the long-only funds out of the traditional speculator might be net short this market. He is trying, the traditional speculator, the hedge fund, the CTA, the floor trader, he's been trying to pick highs in a lot of these commodities, and it's been getting, it's been a very painful experience for him as he's been trying to pick highs for a lot of these commodities. And that's why we also have been arguing that if they raise margin requirements, as is a bill in Congress right now to raise margin requirements to 25% on energy futures, they might just be chasing a seller out of the market. Long-only commodity funds are fully collateralized. They don't operate with margin. The hedge funds, the CTAs, the floor traders do operate with margin. And if they're net short the market, you're just going to chase a seller out of the market and could produce higher prices. Last chart is on page 8, at least in my section, and I'll turn it over to Howard. And I just also wanted to point out that commodity ETFs, the GLD, the StreetTrax Gold Shares, these are also forms of long-only commodity funds that allow the public in order to get into this. The PIMCO Real Return Funds and other real return funds like that, these are forms of long-only funds. Again, these are small markets, and they don't need much money to push them higher. Now, for the final part of the presentation, I wanted to also point out that while we've got this speculative activity, it's our belief that speculative activity does not occur in a vacuum. It does not happen just because it's Thursday and we've decided that we want to ramp up the price of soybeans. Underlying that is typically a bullish fundamental, and speculative activity exaggerates the trend. And that's what's been happening, is the trend has been exaggerated. Without it, you still would have had a huge rise in the price of crude oil anyway. You still would have had a huge rise in the price of a lot of these commodities anyway. Their backdrop has been very bullish. But if you wanted to take the speculative froth out of these markets, I would argue that if the Fed were to raise rates in the August meeting and in the September meeting, then those that are saying the Fed's running inflationary policy, let me into long-only funds, might rethink that view, and it could bring some of the speculative froth out of the markets. But I don't want us to lose the sight that the fundamentals are still, that have been for the last 9 years, very positive on this market. So as we turn to page 9, I'm going to ask Howard, who's been writing a lot about this for us in the last several weeks. He's been writing a lot about this for many years, but ramped up the writing about this for the last several weeks, to come in and talk about what's been happening in the petroleum market. Howard, it's yours.
Okay, thank you, Jim. One conclusion we pretty much have to state up front, and is here in the petroleum section, is let's not confuse commodity prices with inflation. We are going to have significantly higher food prices coming into the end of this year because of what is happening with the flood situation in the corn and soybean growing areas in the Midwest. If you're worried about higher corn prices or about higher soybean prices, the Fed could put the funds rate to 12%, and it's not going to put another ear of corn in a bin somewhere. This is largely out of control right now in the short term of anything that we can do within reason in monetary policy. It is simply going to be a fact. Now, so saying, let's turn back to the petroleum markets. Right now, we have a situation where this trend is getting to be increasingly uncomfortable to the people who are participating in it on both the long and the short side. The fundamental petroleum demand continues to grow. It is an income-related phenomenon. As China grows, as India grows, as internal demand in the oil-exporting countries of the Middle East grows, it is offsetting any demand-dampening effects of higher prices. On the balance there, new supplies have yet to emerge to drive prices lower. For whatever you're finding offshore Brazil, it's going to take a number of years to bring in. You're losing at a rapid rate now in Mexico. You're losing in Nigeria, you're losing in Venezuela, you're losing in Russia because of the expropriations of foreign producers there. Part of this price increase is due to speculation as the weight of alongside money overwhelms a few natural shorts. Very few natural shorts in petroleum right now. If you're a producer, especially in the West Texas Intermediate contract and the grades of crude oil that are deliverable to it, a lot of these fields were brought in with being economic at prices of $10 to $20 a barrel. You're not looking to put a price floor in right now. There's very little forward short side hedge demand. You have to be able to deliver into the NYMEX contract. As we'll see later, you don't have to deliver into the ICE contract. There's speculation, well, so what? That's how a market's supposed to operate. It's supposed to find the point at which behavior changes. In U.S. demand, we're seeing some of that behavior change already, but that's being overwhelmed by demand growth elsewhere. Huge headline shock here. I mean, obviously what happened last Friday, I've been in this market for 30 years, and it was still a sight to behold. But despite the headline shock, we've yet to derail the economy because of higher energy prices. The partial contribution to U.S. equity prices is yet to drive them lower, and it's yet to propel TIPS break-evens higher. The bottom line conclusion here is long-term energy prices are going up, barring a global economic calamity. If you want to lower crude oil prices, it's one of those situations where you better be careful what you wish for. The chart on page 10 is one I've used over the years. I had to go switch to a semi-log scale here on the price because we've doubled in the last year. Those roseate bars, that's the ratio of implied volatility to an underlying high-low close volatility. As those rise, the market is getting more anxious about a price trend. It had fallen throughout the initial phases of the increase, where you see these offsetting green lines. Now it's coming up, and that excess volatility tells you the people who are on the long side are getting much more anxious about the continuity and the sustainability of the trend. I wrote a couple of weeks ago, this breaks is going to be a sight to behold. Went down, what, about $6, $7 and turned right around and made a new high. Let's turn to page 11. This was something that Morgan Stanley had written about last Friday that was part of that huge, which is tanker rates. Remember that oil on the water is a form of inventory to arrive. So if you're going to be buying more crude oil, it's going to show up in higher tanker rates. You don't see anything particularly alarming here, although it is bullish. The terrorists rising out of the Persian Gulf, I don't care whether I'm going east into Asia, Singapore, and Japan, or swinging around Africa to the U.S. Gulf Coast, those are rising. The absolute terrorists from West Africa, though, are coming a little bit off their peaks. That's Nigeria, Angola, both to the U.S. Gulf, and then increasingly to China. The simpler refinery structures in China at the margin have to use the more expensive light sweet crude oil, and they're buying it increasingly out of West Africa. So you do see rising demand there that is bullish. On page 12, and these forward curve and convenience yield charts, a lot of people have said, well, you know, crude oil is in contango. Well, that's a categorically false statement. Crude oil in the first few months may have a positive slope in the carry structure, but when you account for the interest rate costs of holding it and you account for the physical storage costs, you still have what's called a positive convenience yield. It's going to cost you money to buy and hold inventories, but that becomes a break even. That blue line on the top chart. At a fairly modest level of price increase. Moreover, as the price of crude rose, the convenience yield fell. So it's getting to be more and more economic to buy more crude oil, put it in inventory as a form of insurance against future price increases. That demand is bullish. If we turn to slide 13 here, looking at the global inventories, and unfortunately, these data are just come in a couple of months behind. Used to be in the oil industry, you could analyze the U.S. and everything else was kind of a residual that moved in the same way. Marginal demand, marginal supply is outside of the U.S. market right now. We don't have very good data, and the most important number of all, the production capacity out of Saudi Arabia is a very closely guarded state secret. So we only have to infer here. We stopped destocking inventories at the end of the first quarter. That's the series of lines and bars in this top chart on page 13. And in the bottom, we see that the stabilization and refining margins, which had been collapsing, plus this declining backwardation encourages inventory builds. Anything that is going to increase the incentive to buy, to run a refinery, to build inventories, is going to have a bullish effect on price. Page 14, I just tried to address this issue of speculation and long-only funds. The ICE has two big advantages over the NYMEX here. One is that it is a out-of-the-U.S. exchange, technically a British exchange, so your positions are not reported there. Second, it's a cash-settled contract as opposed to physically delivered. The West Texas Intermediate contract is delivered to a pipeline terminus in Cushing, Oklahoma, meaning that you have to actually get the crude oil there or make alternative delivery arrangements in the EFP market. What we see here in the pattern of the open interest is that the ICE contract looks like it's become a favorite for the shorter tenor index swaps used by the long-only funds. I don't think that any moves here to restrict the activities of long-only funds in the U.S. are going to be particularly productive unless you coordinate them not only with the ICE, but with the Dubai Commodity Exchange and anybody else who might arise, because if you can simply move these swaps and the pricing and hedging to an offshore exchange where your regulation is probably not going to be as intense, and you actually achieve nothing other than taking the business out of the U.S. If we turn then to slide 15, get to this global income elasticity of demand. Here we took a look at the five-year change in gasoline consumption as a function of GDP, and I did this both in a local currency, the x-axis, and a U.S. dollar adjusted y-axis basis. The size of those bubbles is the rate of change. Clearly, the larger bubbles off to the right are places where you've either, you know, massively subsidized local gasoline prices, such as Iran and Venezuela, or you have a very rapidly growing economy. It's the slow growth areas on the left side in those white bubbles that you see the price effect. So higher prices are lowering and dampening demand in the developed world. The rising income elasticity is simply overwhelming that outside of the G7 or OECD economies. That is unlikely to change, and as I said earlier, it's one of those cases of be careful what you wish for, because if you raise interest rates enough to the point where somebody dies, which is the usual thing that we do when we start raising interest rates. I mean, after all, when Paul Volcker did in the early 80s, we managed to kill Mexico, and we managed to kill Argentina. So be careful what we wish for on this. There's probably no level of U.S. interest rates that's going to slow the growth down in these areas. The oil exporters are now getting revenue in at a rate that is absolutely unprecedented in human history. They're going to be a little bit sloppy in what they do, because they have no idea of how to spend it wisely or invest it wisely. It's just coming in too fast. If we turn to slide 16, it's a point that I've been making in the U.S., that our implied gasoline demand has actually been rising on a seasonally adjusted basis pretty much on a straight line over a time. I took the American Petroleum Institute data here, which goes back to 1979. If we then adjust for its productivity, that blue line, we find that we keep adding economic value. You're not going to change behavior if you have to spend $4 on a gallon of gasoline and you create $5 of economic output when you do it. If you spend $4 on a gallon and you create $3 out of it, then you're going to change your behavior. If we look at the slide on the bottom, which is comparing gasoline demand in the blue to its constant dollar level here, you really don't see very much of a price elasticity effect, and you don't see very much of a lead lag effect. Price elasticity of demand is kind of a nice theory, but it has to be blended in with productivity changes, increasing efficiency of engines, lower energy usage in capital stock to have an overall effect on demand. So the U.S. picture here, which we are still the largest gasoline consumer, energy consumer in the world, shows that the price effects are not exactly what you would expect on the demand side, and we haven't seen any supply effect to speak of because of higher prices. I'm trying to get to slide 17 here. Which is the relationship between crude oil and equities. Whenever I write this one, I say to myself, people are going to think you're absolutely nuts. What do you mean that higher crude oil prices don't knock the stock market down? Well, went back to January 1983 here, which is more than 25 years, and if you map the S&P 500 weekly average, and West Texas Intermediate weekly average. What you really see here are two trading ranges. One is vertical with the price below $40. One's horizontal with the price greater than $40. Nowhere in here do you see a negative relationship. As a matter of fact, if I wanted to put a log linear trend line in both those boxes, both of them would be moving slightly, you know, from the southwest to the northeast. It would be positively sloped. If I take a look at the rolling 13-week calendar quarter correlation of weekly returns there, we find that sometimes it's positive and sometimes it's negative, which says that the relationship is essentially random, that there is no long-term and there is no short-term negative correlation of returns, which leads me to the table on slide 18, which I crank out every few weeks, which is to say, what's the industry group impact? The cells on the left here are all the industry groups in the S&P that have a negative beta to crude oil prices, and it's a very long list. It's 62 industry groups. The betas tend to be fairly low. It's a very short list on the right, 16. The betas tend to be very high, and they tend to have a large weight in the index itself. So if I sum these, I get a positive, not a negative, net contribution of rising crude oil prices in the U.S. stock market. The data sample here, in case you're wondering, goes back to May of 2003. This was the day where we declared war on deflation. I'm happy to report that war is proceeding very well. We should win it at any time now. On slide 19, gasoline prices and U.S. inflation. If I take a look at the gasoline price here and I take a look at the CPI, I find I can run a timeline through the CPI and I get an R-squared of 996. That's almost perfect. If I do it for gasoline, it's 0.469, so I can explain more than twice the variance in the CPI by just taking a ruler out and putting it over a time scale on the calendar than I can by using gasoline. Everybody associates higher gasoline prices with higher inflation. I think the causation clearly goes the other way around. It certainly did in the 1970s, where we had higher inflation leading first to a grain shock then to an oil shock. Remember that Richard Nixon imposed wage and price controls in August of 1971. We didn't have our first oil shock until late 1973. It's very difficult to cause something to happen 2 years previously. And then if we look on slide 20 of energy prices and tips break evens, everybody wants to say the forward-looking inflation reflects the CPI, which should reflect gasoline prices. Here again, these correlations tend to be low. They seldom exceed 0.8. They sometimes go negative. I did this for the 1-2 5 and 10 year tips. I just displayed the 2 and 5 here. It's very difficult to say that we should be trading tips off of energy prices, and I used here natural gas, I used heating oil, and I used gasoline. So I took three different markets. What's the reason for this is tips are massively distorted by two things. One which I've written about for years, and that is that you're actually short a call option on government honesty. If you believe that the non-seasonally adjusted CPI, the all-urban one, is an accurate statement of your own consumer price index, so let me know immediately. They're in control of how they report this number. The second is the tips break-even is the residual between the nominal treasury and the inflation-adjusted treasury. If you get the flight to quality, you're actually buying insurance against a financial crash elsewhere that has very little to do with expected inflation, and yet that knocks the TIPS break even down, even when we clearly have rising inflation. With that, that concludes what I wanted to speak about this morning. So I guess, Jim, we turn the conference back to questions now.
Yes, thanks, Howard. two ways you can ask questions. You can hit 7-pound on your phone, and you can ask a question directly, or you could send me an email. You can either hit reply to the email that you got from us this morning with the conference call, or you could send it to jbianco, J-B-I-A-N-C-O, at biancoresearch.com. A couple of things about questions. We do encourage questions, and we found that the best way to encourage questions is to tell people that we will only use your first name in a question. And so be on the lookout for your first name in the question, and because the anonymous nature of it, I think, encourages more questions. I've already got two email questions that have come in, and we've got some on hold. So let me start with the email questions. The first one is from Max. The question is, what do you make of the history that shows that the market is typically very early in expecting a renewed tightening cycle after an easing cycle? I would agree with you, Max. It is very easy. We just went to 2% at the last meeting, and we're already starting to price in one meeting of hold, and then one meeting after that, we're going to hike. So this has been quite the quick turnaround if it does play out the way it has. And I guess the answer I would give you is a twofold answer. This is unique in that the Fed has been responding to a credit crisis more than it has been responding to the economy. And second of all, it's clearly the case that the Fed is in a point in the with the funds rate that they are below what we would consider to be neutral. They are clearly in an easy mode or an easy period. So it's not like we're debating whether or not 2% is the appropriate rate. I think that debate has been pretty much settled even by Fed governors. It's too low, but it's too low with reason. So it's not surprising to me that if the funds rate is too low, that we could quickly see a change from we just eased at the last meeting, hold at this meeting, and the market might want to look to hike at the next meeting. The next emailed question comes from Jeff, and it's more of a procedural question about the chart on page 8 about commodity ETFs. He's asking if that commodity ETFs includes the London ETFs or just U.S. registered. And the answer is it just includes U.S. registered. As the chart shows, the source is the Investment Company Institute, and the Investment Company Institute only covers the U.S. registered ETFs. And even though it is only the U.S. registered ETFs, it has more than doubled in the last year. And we do know that there's quite a number of ETFs, again, another version of the long-only funds, that trade on the London exchanges. The next question is a call-in question. It comes from Brian. Brian, are you there?
I am.
Go ahead.
So my question, I guess I just wanted to play devil's advocate a little bit with the discussion about chart 16, which is the conclusion of which seemed to be on the bottom chart, was that price effects don't have much impact on the demand side. And I'm trying to square that with, and I'm not an expert on the energy business or the oil market, but I'm seeing big surges in public transit ridership, miles driven down, SUV sales falling, airlines taking planes out of service. Can you help me reconcile, those anecdotal pieces of information with the conclusion you drew out of the graph?
What is really surprising there is if you look at the week by week gasoline demand numbers that and if you're sitting in front of your Bloomberg, it's API D MGID index, and if you just do an HP on that, that's API D MGID. You look at those numbers there, and okay, we're down a little bit from our mid-May levels, but if we look where we were seasonally adjusted, let's say even a year ago. It's not anything significant, and we don't know right now whether this is a price effect or whether it's an income effect. The previous patterns of whenever we've had gasoline prices is you get a short-term reaction. I'm going to keep the car in the garage. I'm going to get on the train. I'm going to walk. I'm going to take a bicycle. I'm going to do something to reduce my gasoline demand, and then it creeps back. That's been the pattern going back for 30 years into the first gasoline shock. So, yes, we've had a little bit of a drop-off here in a couple of weeks, but we haven't seen a sustained trend where we can point to a growing negative price elasticity of demand.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. The next question is another emailed question, and it comes from Mike. Why, and Howard, I think this is probably better for you. Why has gold not been validating this recent heightened concern over inflation? Is it that the gold market believes that the Fed will in fact hike as necessary?
Gold has been reacting contrary to its fundamentals for a long time here. It's something that I've looked at both in terms of reported inflation, expected inflation, dollar adjusted, related to short-term interest rates. What I think has happened here is you've had a significant...
The current talker has been muted.
I just got something that says...
Go ahead.
The big drop in gold demand worldwide has been coming out of India, which has always been the largest gold importer, and there I think it is a price shock, where traditionally the household wore its wealth in the form of gold jewelry on the women of the household. So now you physically need less gold to wear the same amount of wealth, and it's also wealth. Can we find another way of storing accumulated savings other than gold jewelry? So there's a lot of factors that are going on. Gold peaked, a long time ago while we were still. Give you the exact date here. Cash gold peaked on March 17th, which is the Bear Stearns bailout date. Fell off pretty significantly after that, and inflation expectations have risen after that. Gold is actually not a very good hedge against inflation. It always surprises people. It's a piece that I've done and updated a few times. It says over the last 25 years, you were actually better off than holding T-bills than you were holding gold as far as an inflation hedge. That tends to drive gold bugs absolutely up a wall.
Okay, next question. Next question, Michael. Michael, are you there?
Yes, hi. What are the implications on the government bond market? You said U.S. Treasury's yields have all backed up significantly, so have the European bonds. What is your position in terms of the government bonds?
Yield curve is most likely going to continue to flatten as we continue to talk about whether or not the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates this summer and into the fall. That will primarily come from a position of short rates moving up faster than long rates. And I do think, though, that in this environment, you're going to have a very difficult time getting a severe down move in government bond yields, barring a calamity in the stock market. If you are bullish right now on government bonds, you're betting on probably one of two things. You're either taking the view that inflation is not a problem, or you're taking the view that we're going to have another train wreck, another August or another March in the U.S. stock market. At this point, while I do think that U.S. stocks could head lower, I'm not ready to go all the way out and say that they're going to fall apart a la March just yet. They are going to go down, but that's more of a thing about the rate of change as opposed to the direction of change. Howard, did you want to add anything to that?
I've been expecting the bond yields to rise for the better part of 5 years from now. One of these days I'm going to be right. The simple fact of the matter is that you're not getting a positive after-tax real adjusted rate of return in holding almost anybody's government bonds. That makes them a rather suspect investment if and when we can pick up asset returns elsewhere. And with rising inflation, bonds tend to be a very poor long-term investment.
Okay. Michael, did you have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, just to chart three on the Case-Shiller. Existing home sale prices have actually adjusted to the point where some would say that prices have stabilized. Yet this is not depicted in the Case-Shiller. How do you reconcile these two?
Mainly because of the construction of the two indexes. The Case-Shiller index is a measure of existing home prices only in the major cities, either the Case-Shiller 10, which is the 10 largest cities, or the Case-Shiller 20, which is the 20 largest cities, where the Census Bureau's measures of existing home prices is a survey of the entire country. We do have a bifurcated real estate market in the United States. The large urban areas are where we had the big run-up, and you could see that in Case-Shiller. It got over almost up to 15-16% a couple of years ago, which would have been the highest level in many decades, and we've had a big collapse. But in the rural areas, they've never quite experienced the giddiness of the real estate market, so they're not getting the collapse in the real estate market to the degree that we're seeing in the cities. Case-Shiller did do a measure back over 100 years, where existing home sales only goes back about 30 years. Case-Shiller has become the kind of favorite measure of the market to look at, and so that's why we've been focusing on it. But I think in large part it comes from the construction of the two indices. Do you have a final follow-up to that?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The
calls that we've got, but we do have a couple of more emailed calls. Fiona, what is your view of oil demand from Asia and the emerging markets? How quickly do you expect to see subsidies being lifted on local energy prices in these economies? Will lifting or reducing the subsidies have a meaningful effect? Howard, did you want to take that one?
Well, oil demand is going to rise as a function of income. If we have a macro calamity in China, we have a macro calamity in India, oil demand will fall. You cannot expect people who have waited 30, 40 years to get their first car to say, you know what, I'm gonna stay on the bicycle, I'm gonna stay on the moped, I'm gonna walk. No, I want my car. I've worked my whole life for my car. The growth in industrial demand in China has not slowed at all. There are people who have said that China has stockpiled a lot of diesel fuel going into the Olympics to make sure that everything runs smoothly there, that they're using residual fuel oil in place of coal for electric power generation to lower the pollution. So that may have a drop after August. I don't expect to see radical lifting of subsidies, because the typical political reaction to that is rioting in the streets, and governments tend to try and avoid that. So the subsidies are going to be lifted gradually to the point where they don't produce rioting. That will have something of an effect on demand at the margin, but once again, that gets offset by macro growth. So I'm looking for continued growth in the Asian markets and in emerging markets in general, especially in the oil exporting markets in the Persian Gulf.
We got a couple of more emailed questions. Another one on crude oil comes from Nina. Traditionally, U.S. consumption of oil via gasoline consumption was the biggest hog of daily consumption on a worldwide basis. Mm-hmm. Can you estimate the potential reduced demand in numerical terms for U.S. consumers based on historical experience 1970s and put the same type of estimate numerically for the emerging market consumer. At what rate is daily usage increasing as measured in millions of barrels per day for the emerging markets, broadly speaking?
I don't have a concrete answer for that, because the data simply is not that that reliable, nor is it that timely. We do know from the experience in the late 70s and early 1980s, the short-term price elasticities were fairly low in the OECD world, and then they got to be fairly significant in the early 80s. But we also know that there is a an offsetting income elasticity demand that that's greater than that in the long term. So I don't once again I don't expect to see, unless price just does something utterly outrageous, I don't expect to see a demand fall. I cannot give you a concrete volumetric number on that.
Okay. We have we usually limit this to an hour. We got 3 minutes left, and I've got three more questions. So let's see how we do here. Next question is from Richard. If employment shows no net growth between now and November, will the Fed be able to tighten? If oil goes to 100, won't that take the heat off the inflation story to the point where the Fed won't have to tighten for that reason? If oil is at 150, won't the economy stall as consumption ex energy collapses? Would anyone think oil has yet reached a stable place? Let me take a stab at this one. If employment shows no net growth between now and November, will the Fed be able to tighten? There's been a lot of studies that have been thrown out on the internet, at least from Wall Street being emailed around, that the Fed has never tightened while we've had negative payroll growth, and most of those studies go back to 1989. If you take those studies back into the 1970s, I do believe you might have found a period or two where that has happened in the 1970s. Furthermore, if you wanted to turn that argument around, since 1989, this is the only period of negative payroll growth that also has seen heightened inflation expectations. Typically, when we get into a period of negative payroll growth, demand is coming off, the economy is moving lower, and people are not expecting increasing inflation. That's since 1989. I know that everybody's been emailing that around saying the Fed doesn't tighten when we've got negative payrolls. But yeah, but we also don't see inflation expectations going up with negative payrolls since 1989. Take them back to the 1970s, and you can find an example of that. Second half, if oil goes to 100, won't that take the heat off the inflation story to the point where the Fed won't have to tighten for that reason? I would argue, yes, it would. If you were to see oil go back to 100, at least it would back everything up. But first, oil has to go back to 100 before we can actually see that. I mean, if it goes back to 50, that would help too. If it went back to 10, that would help. It doesn't mean it's going to have to happen there. And so, yes, if oil were to go back to 100. And the final part of this, and I'll let you take a stab at this, Howard, if oil is at 150, won't the economy stall as X energy collapses? 150 is only what, 6 or 7% where we are right now.
You know, every $10 we keep waiting, you know, for the lights to turn off, and it hasn't happened yet. Let's face it, if I came in here 2 years ago and said, okay, I'm bullish on crude oil, I think we're going to go to 135 first, you know, nobody would have listened to me. Second, I wouldn't have believed it myself. And third, I would have believed that it would have caused a complete collapse in economic activity. Right now, what we see is a huge boom in the export sector and construction engineering services to the oil exporters. So yes, you're hitting consumer activity, but you're not necessarily slicing activity in the material sector, in the industrial sector, export-oriented, service sectors. That's one of the reasons why we've been able to accommodate the higher oil prices. Believe it or not, there are gainers from it as well as losers. I mean, take a look at the steel industry, for example. I mean, if you drill an oil well, that's a steel for 58 cars going down into the ground. It's a very big stimulus to demand.
Two more questions, and then we'll wrap this up. Emailed questions, because I think they're somewhat interesting. One for me, one for Howard. The first one is from Stephen. If Fed policy adjusts to allow weaker banks, other financial institutions to fail, isn't this a calamity for the stock market? If the question is, if the Fed allows financial institutions to fail, yes, that's a problem for the stock market. But if the answer is, if the Fed does whatever it takes to save these weak financial institutions at the expense of higher inflation for everybody else, that's also a calamity for the stock market. There is it is a difficult position that the Fed is being put in right now. As I said earlier, early on, from August to maybe 6 weeks ago, the Fed was able to attack this credit crisis without consequence. Now the consequence is perceived to be higher expected inflation because the Fed is running easy policy. So the question becomes, and let's you know, put it straight up. The question becomes straightforward. Which is worse for the economy? If a firm like Lehman Brothers or a firm of Lehman Brothers statue fails and let everybody on Wall Street pick up the pieces, or whatever we want to define as fails, or do whatever it takes to save them and stick everybody else with higher inflation expectations. So it's not just a one-choice thing. Save the financial institution to hold the stock market together. Saving the financial institution now has a cost. Last question for you, Howard, from Neil. Has muted CPI increase been masked by our shipping our wages to China? Now that China is experiencing wage inflation, will we see the increased gasoline prices as a better indicator of CPI in the U.S.?
Well, that's a couple of interesting questions there, because what we had before, whenever we lowered monetary policy, it got easier, is we created asset in inflation. This is the first time that we've been stimulative in the last 25 years and have created price inflation. We haven't seen it in wages yet. So the pricing power of companies has increased, wages haven't, because we have a global market now in wages, not only in the industrial sector, but increasingly in anything that can be done over the internet in the information based sector. So yes, there has been upward wage pressure in China as a result of the transmission mechanism of the yuan staying in a managed peg, managed revaluation against the dollar. Is gasoline a better measure of inflation? That's really hard to say, because remember, gasoline is a consumed resource. It's not a static resource. I think you have to look at something that is a constant market basket as opposed to a single commodity rule. One of the reasons why for centuries you could use gold as a monetary proxy is because you don't consume it. But gasoline, you consume, it disappears, it has production constraints, it has all measure of external factors. So I would not look to gasoline as a measure of where inflation is going to be, just the same way I wouldn't look at anything in the food sector coming up as to saying what is inflation going to be. Now, this is not an argument in favor of core inflation, which I think is nonsense, but it's simply saying that we're going to have a crop failure or a crop shortfall. Does that mean that we have higher inflation because we had rain in the Midwest in May and June that flooded the fields? That's a much harder argument to make. And incidentally, I want to turn back just a previous question Jim had answered. By letting firms fail, you kind of avoid the Japanese mistake in the 90s where they kept a lot of their banks brain dead by not letting any of them fail. At some point, you're just going to have to say, you know what, you made a bet, you lost, you're out of business, we're not going to try and save everybody by creating inflation because it's not going to work. Somebody's going to have to die here.
I said that was going to be the last question, but I lied. We got one more that came in, Howard, and I thought it was worth answering, and it's, forecasters are predicting $200 oil like Goldman. What are your thoughts about the future price of natural gas, and when do we see a substitution effect of natural gas for oil or gas fuel for coal for oil?
Well, the short term in natural gas is very bullish because over the last decade, we have been drilling and not replacing reserves to the extent that we thought we would. You can find natural gas relatively easily through large parts of the country, but you cannot find the so-called elephant fields that you really need. So natural gas is kind of a dwindling resource in this country until we get large-scale importation of LNG, liquefied natural gas. We're going to see a very high natural gas price environment. I wrote a piece about, what, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, saying this is going to be the next energy primal scream, is when people start getting their heating bills this winter, because natural gas is going to remain at $10 to $12 minimum going forward, and that is that's at risk if we have any hurricanes later this summer and earlier this fall. If we get a repeat of 2004-2005 in the Atlantic hurricane season, we could have a disaster in home heating at the same time we're having a crop shortfall in corn, at the same time that we think it's a good idea to feed a third of our corn crop to yeast instead of to people in Africa. So we are looking at some very significant rising price levels in both food and energy.
Okay, let's wrap that up there. We ran a little bit long. I tried to keep it to 60 minutes, and we're at 68 minutes, but I saw enough people were hanging on the line that it was worthwhile, and these were good questions. So I want to thank everybody for joining us on the monthly conference call, and we will talk to you again next month. Bye-bye.